Welcome to the 386th episode of the So Video Games Podcast, where I talk about any game at all, including new stuff, old stuff, and anything in between. If I am playing it, I'll be talking about it. Today, I am recording on April 30th, 2024. My name is Brad Galloway, and I am not only the host of this show, but I'm also the editor of GameCritics.com. Thanks for joining me today. So, frequent listeners of the show may notice that the intro I just read was a little bit different than usual, and that is correct. My longtime co-host, Carlos Rodella, will be taking an extended leave of absence from the show. I wish him nothing but the best. In the meantime, this leaves me with a couple of questions about the future of So Video Games, this podcast right here. But let me answer the biggest one right now. The show itself is not going anywhere. There's absolutely no plans to stop the weekly broadcast. So you can expect to keep getting this show on the reg, just like always. Otherwise, I think I'm going to take a note from good friend John over at Gaming in the Wild. Listen to his show if you don't already. I'm sure you probably do. And I think I'm going to just record solo for a while to see how that goes. There are no current plans to replace Carlos with anyone for the foreseeable future. I am in no rush to get a co-host on board. If something happens organically, great. Otherwise, I think I'm going to lone wolf it, and it'll be pretty much business as usual. Tons of game coverage, news bits here and there, and in general, I think I'm going to try to improve my podcast editing skills. So that's about it. If anybody has questions or comments, please feel free to drop me a line. You can get in touch. I'll have the contact information at the end of the show, as per usual. And I guess that's it. Now that we've covered this big shift and are starting this new reality, I guess let's just get down to it. As per usual, today's show kicks off with housekeeping, where I'm going to be discussing tidbits, news items, industry happenings, and basically anything just randomly game adjacent. Just a couple of things this week. First, I want to give a shout out to LCB Game Studio. I love their Pixel Pulps series. I think it's fantastic. If you haven't played them, please check them out. They're all really short, kind of choose-your-own-adventure-y pixel art style stuff with this kind of shared universe they're building. It's really great. I love their stuff a lot. They have this kind of little side project in all of their games where they do, like, they do the story-based game. One's about a vampire, one's about a mothman, one is about these guys who chase storms on the road. So each game has its own plot. But within each game, they usually do some kind of like ornate card game as like the bonus activity. And I guess they've taken that one step further because they just released a card game all by itself in the same pixel art style, but without the choose-your-own-adventure part attached to it. It's just the side game. It's called Summoning Solitaire, and it was just released a couple days ago. I've downloaded it. I haven't had a chance to play it yet, but it's out there. It's free. You can download it from LCB's website. You can check them out on Twitter. I'm sure you can find the link there. Maybe do a Google search. So I'm very excited to crack into this one. But it's called Summoning Solitaire. And if it's anything like their others, it's going to be a good time. Also, Slytherin, the publisher, has just announced that they are going to be taking over the development of all future content for Warhammer 40K Battle Sector, which is great. Battle Sector is one of the best 40K games to come out in quite some time. I covered it here on the show a while ago. Basically, it's a pretty straightforward interpretation of 40K in turn-based tactics style, which makes perfect sense because that's really what 40K is all about. And I think that Battle Sector was great. It had a really great campaign, very solid, lots of different units, good length to it, good twists and turns, good level design. But once you got through the campaign, they kind of resorted to, skirmish mode, basically. There's a lot of DLC where you can introduce other characters, like the Sororitas sisters. I think the Tau aliens are there. Like, so you can get some DLC to, like, expand the roster. But as far as I know, and I just checked it out a couple days ago, it doesn't seem like there's any new, like, story or campaign content, which is what I really wanted. I mean, skirmish mode is fine, but it just doesn't keep my attention the same way that doing, like, pre-structured, you know, handcrafted levels and progression does. So hopefully, now that Slytherin is taking over for the previous developer, they will maybe lean back into story mode. And Slytherin, if you're listening, please do that. I would love to come back to Battle Sector. And in fact, I'm kind of in a 40K mood right now. I was almost thinking of just replaying the campaign, which I almost never do. But it was a good campaign, and I love the 40K stuff that they're doing. Hopefully they'll do some story-based stuff. I would love brief story-based missions or a little story content or just anything that's not just more characters, more skirmish mode. So if you're listening, please lean into that. That would be great. They are apparently going to take over the game engine, and they are going to be working collaboratively with other developers to produce DLC, which they have said themselves will be broader in scope than anything released before, which to me hopefully says something more than just skirmish mode. Because skirmish is great, but you know, I'm definitely a campaign kind of guy. I would love story campaigns. Just anything along those lines, I would eat it up, no problem. Also, just a heads up that the ID at Xbox presentation happened, I think, a day ago, if memory serves. I did not have time to watch it, and in fact, I'm just kind of catching up on some of the news now. So I'm just scratching the surface, but just in case you didn't see it or didn't catch it, just know that it happened. I may have some notes on it next week, depending if there's anything there that's juicy enough, but it did happen, so just a heads up. All right, so that was housekeeping. Just one quick note before I move on here. So I'm changing the way that I'm recording a little bit, and I would love to get your feedback on this show. So if there's any tips or anything that you like or don't like about the sound quality, I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but I'm in a slightly different setup, and I changed a few things on how we're recording now that I'm taking over the editing duties myself. So I'm open to feedback. If you guys think it sounds fine, please let me know. If you think there's something I can improve, if there's something about it that doesn't sound quite right or whatever, please send me your feedback. That would be wonderful, because to me, I did a few test recordings and it sounds fine, but I'm the first one to admit that I don't have like an audiophile's ear. So if the podcast sounds great, please let me know. If it doesn't, I do want to improve that, and I'll do whatever I can to get that in better shape. So to you discerning ears out there, to people who have the ear for the finer audio qualities, if there's something that's bothering you, please let me know and I'll fix that up. Or if it sounds great, please let me know that too. Very appreciated. Would be. Okay. Let's see. Also, before we get to the main portion of the show, I just want to quickly remind folks that you can help support this podcast by going to patreon.com/thesovideogamespodcast. Every little bit helps with the cost of hosting, and I may need to upgrade some equipment possibly, so we'll see about that. Also, a huge, huge thanks to all of our Patreon supporters. I really appreciate you all very much. And this week, a special shout out to Ryan for joining the SVG, that's So Video Games, family. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. So, also I want to say I am super grateful to everyone who does keep the show going, who does contribute. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. But you can rest assured that whether you contribute or not, I'm not going to paywall any of the episodes or content. You will still get the same great show for free every week. Also, there is a Sovity Games Discord, which any listener is welcome to join. Again, free of charge. Trying to give you guys the best value for money by not requiring you to give me any money. Therefore, automatically a good value. If you want to join up and continue the discussion after the show, or just, you know, chat with us, meet some new folks, you can join this Discord for free. Just shoot me an email and I will give you the details. Okay, I think that's it for the opening stuff. Let's get into the main portion of the show here. All right, I introduced a new segment last week called Circlebacks, and that was about any game that I'm playing that I just haven't quite finished, but we've covered it a few times. Maybe I want to give a brief update to something. I'm looking forward to using this feature, and I did use it last week. Unfortunately, I don't have anything this week, so just know that that will be a thing coming up in the future, but nothing this week. We're going to get right into the brand new games coverage. First up is Sandland. This is the expansive open world story-based action RPG coming from Namco Bandai and creator Akira Toriyama, who just recently passed away. Please rest in peace. This is the last thing that Mr. Toriyama worked on, and I think it's pretty good so far. I think it's good work. I'm glad to see that, at least based on my impression so far, this is something that's worthy of the legacy. You know, Toriyama is, I mean, like a legend, right? Done so many things. Original Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z, Dragon Quest stuff. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. And I think that Sandland, despite being recent and his most newest thing, it definitely is in line with previous work in terms of his style, sensibilities, art, of course. Just seems like the total package so far. I'm just scratching the surface, so I'm going to just not dwell too long on this. And I'll certainly talk about it next week in the circle back portion. But Sandland is not just a game. It's also an anime. It's on Hulu in the States right now. And I've seen the first, I want to say, 4 episodes of it. And it's good. It's really good. I am quite enjoying it, watching it with my son. And I think the anime starts out strong. It's mostly killer, very little filler. And the story is about a world where water is a precious commodity. You might be able to guess that from the title, Sand Land, because the land that these people live in is like this desolate desert, just dry, you know, sand and rocks and lizards and stuff. It's just a real struggle to survive there. I'm not going to get too far into the details, but in this world, there are humans and there are demons, and they don't really care for each other too much. They kind of give each other their space and go their separate ways. But what ends up happening is that one human finds out that there may be a source of water far away in the desert, and he needs help to get there. Demons are much tougher and more resilient, better at fighting than humans are. And so he goes to this demon village to recruit some demons to go with him. This human's name is named Rao, and he recruits Beelzebub, who is the Prince of Darkness. Not the actual ruler of darkness, but the Prince of Darkness. He's number two. His dad is, I guess, Satan or Lucifer or something like that. So they team up and they go off for this grand adventure in the desert, and things kick off from there. Really liking the anime, definitely recommend that. And it's interesting because watching the anime, there are many beat for beat parallels in the opening hours of the game, but also some differences. I think that if you are playing the game, you will get the full experience because they do take the time to like lay the story out. But also if you're watching the anime, you will get some added benefit because you'll see certain things that are handled differently. And I think it's a good counterpoint to each other. So I'm enjoying watching the show and playing the game at the same time. Let's talk about the game itself. So far, it's kind of a banger. I haven't played a JRPG in a while. I'm kind of over them, but something about Sandland was really talking to me. And I think this is not exactly a JRPG, but more of an action, open-worldy RPG. And I haven't played a ton of those lately, so I'm open to that at the moment. Let's see here. So basically, you start the game. You take control of Beelzebub. He's a little guy. He's kind of pink. He's got a little bit of a Goku energy about him. And you team up with Rao, the human guy, to go and, you know, go on this quest to find the water. We did the demo. We covered the demo a while ago on the show. And I'm actually glad to see that while they did give you this kind of vertical slice of the different vehicles and stuff, it's much better in the actual game because there's more context. They work up to it. You get more sense of the world and everything. So I'm glad to see that the demo was exactly that, just a demo. And the real product is much better. And the demo was not quite representative of what we got, which is good. It's good. I like the mechanics of it. You can walk around. There's a dodge. You have little super abilities. You have a skill tree. You do some brief combos. The combat stuff is straightforward. I haven't leveled up too much. It seems like there's a bunch of stuff on the skill tree that I haven't gotten to yet. So I'm looking forward to that. But you can go on foot. Briefly, you get a little car to drive around in. The world is kind of an open world. Open-ish, anyway, where there's like large stretches where you're free to wander around, look for caves, resources, treasure chests, fight monsters. But there's also, it's also kind of like gated off a little bit, too. You can't just go anywhere. You are within these giant chunks of the world, at least so far. You soon get the tank, which has been in all the promo art. It's on the cover of the box. It's on in the cartoon. The tank is, I think, the main portion where you steal this tank and you go on this grand adventure with these people. It's Beelzebub, Rao, and you have one more person with you. His name is Thief. He happens to be a thief. And then you do this wild stuff. I like it so far. I think it's good. I don't have much more to say at the moment other than it's really free-flowing and there's such a good energy to it. When you start the game, I was afraid it was going to get bogged down with like a lot of like dialogue and, you know, a bunch of cruft to work through, a lot of the usual JRPG tropes. It's kind of turned me off, but I will say they've really streamlined everything. Like once you start the game, it feels almost like you're just on this roller coaster where there are some story bits, there is some conversation, But you are doing stuff right away. Like you drive a car and then you like get chased by this dragon and then you're like fighting guys and then you talk some more and then you go. And it just, things happen at a really good clip. It feels like the world is just flowing. And it's almost like you're watching a show as you're playing this game. Just the events keep happening and you just really just, you don't ever get mired in anything. I haven't done any grinding at all so far. Like it's just like beat after beat after beat after beat. And I dig it. I love the pace. It's really fast paced. I mean, that may change. There's like a lot of game ahead of me. So that's absolutely something that could change as we get further in. I'm sure the structure will change. But so far, I'm really liking it. Just the action feels good. Driving the tank is fun. I like the characters. I like the story. Graphics are amazing. Like, it looks really beautiful. The anime style translate wonderfully to the video game world. I think what they've done here is great. It looks, I mean, if you're squinting, I think you would be really hard-pressed to tell which one was the cartoon and which one was the video game, which is amazing. But overall, it's just really fun, really positive. I like the way it feels. Good mechanics, good story. Everything about this game is popping. And I know that one of our writers at Game Critics, I believe it was Jason, who just covered it. The review has not gone up quite yet. I think we're waiting for an edit from Jason. But I read the first draft, and he loved it as well. He had like basically nothing bad to say about it at all. He just loved it all the way through. And he gave it pretty much top marks. So that has given me a lot of hope. Sandland is looking like a winner. And I feel like it's a winner. It seems like it's going to be a winner. So TBD, I'm not saying it is a winner yet, but man, all lights are green. So look forward to hearing more about this one pretty soon. All right, next up is Bulwark Falconeer Chronicles. I believe the developer for this is named Tomas Sala, I think. I'm pretty sure that's what his name is. Apologies if I got that wrong. This is the second in a announced Falconeer Chronicles trilogy. The first one was called, I think, just The Falconeer, which was a very interesting game, if not an enjoyable one. That original Falconeer had a really strong like aesthetic sense to it. It's a world that was mostly ocean with little islands dotting it. People in that world flew giant falcons to kind of, you know, do missions and fight with each other, and you know, just the image of these giant falcons flying over this like watery world with just little fortresses rising out of the ocean and being buffeted by the waves was pretty cool. I will say that mechanically I did not enjoy that game. I think it had a lot of structural problems, a lot of design problems, but I like the concept. I like the feeling of it. It gave me like all the best vibes. Unfortunately, it just didn't come together in an experience that was fun to play. But, I mean, it seems like a lot of potential there. And from what I understand, Mr. Sala is either a solo developer or just leads a very small team. Not sure which, but we're definitely not talking AAA here, which I also respect. You know, you have to kind of adjust your expectations and cut them a little slack wherever it's due. So this is the second, Bulwark, Part 2 of the Falconeer Chronicles. He takes a hard left turn and does something different. It's still set in the world, of course. Like, we're still in the ocean world. The little islands, fortresses sticking up out of the waves, falcons and all that stuff. But this is no longer like an aerial combat, falcon-to-falcon fighting thing. This is more like... I hesitate to call it a city builder because it almost feels like a digital toy of some kind. There have been a few games lately where the point of it is just to enjoy building buildings. Their names escape me at the moment, but I've played at least two or three of them recently where you're just kind of clicking on things and like buildings will appear and you're really just here to build and just kind of like aesthetically take in the visuals of that. And it's just, you know, maybe no goals or whatever. I feel like Mr. Sala must have certainly been inspired by those games because I think there's a lot of DNA here, but Bulwark kind of straddles this weird, uncomfortable middle ground between being one of those digital toys and being kind of a, I don't know, like a world sim, building sim, kind of an RTS, maybe. It's kind of this weird space that it occupies here, and I guess I just don't quite know what to do with it. As the game begins, you have this piece of rock, and the tutorial starts off by saying, let's build some stuff, and that's fine. You build a little tower, and then you get some resources and everything, but it doesn't... Oh, man, it's struggled to even explain this, because I don't feel like any of it really matters. I didn't quite understand the resource system. I didn't quite understand how the relationships between the buildings and your population worked. And, I mean, honestly, I was just kind of like... clicking things at random, and things were kind of randomly happening, and buildings were building, and towers were going up, and you know, things were moving around, but it didn't feel like I was really in control of any of it. It just kind of felt like I was sort of like watching it happen. There's this one menu you can hit where it shows you like the quote unquote resource flow, and it shows you the lines of like, oh, you're getting metal from over here and you're getting wood from over here, and it shows you the arrows of which way that stuff is flowing. But I'm like, it didn't mean anything. I didn't really feel like it was relevant to what was happening. So I it's just kind of strange. Like it's like a digital toy, but there are the trappings that should be more, but despite my trying to dig into it, it didn't really feel like any of it really had any effect or was really significant. I was pretty fine to just ignore most of that and click around. There's also this mode where you take control of a little blimp and you can fly around other parts of the world to, I guess, look for more resources and just see what you can see. But it's weird because the ability to gain resources is tightly controlled. And so once I set up my first outpost, I wasn't able to set up any more outposts because apparently I didn't find this out in the game because it doesn't communicate this well. But apparently you need to like find these resource collectors from like fights, or maybe it's story progression or something. But that wasn't really made clear. And so I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to be doing. And it's interesting too, because the game itself says there are no wrong answers. Like, I don't know the exact phrasing, but it was like, nothing is wrong. Play around with it. Explore. Do what you want to do. Nothing bad's going to happen. Which to me definitely puts it on the side of digital toy. But also, it just looks like it wants to be an RTS. Like, it wants to be a sim, but I just don't think it's there. I will say also the controls are really weird in this one, and I found that to be true with the original Falconeer as well. Something about this just is not making sense to my brain. The way the camera works is really funky. The way that you cannot just move around the way you want to feels really funky. I don't know why these choices were made, but it seems the camera is tied to certain things in the environment in a way that feels very unintuitive and very unnatural. So I had difficulty just like looking around. I just kind of beat my head against the wall with this one. Like it looks so cool, just like the original Falconeer did. Like, you look at this, there's falcons, there's water, there's clouds. This world is so interesting. It seems like something I want to learn more about. I kind of want to be there a little bit. But actually playing this game, playing Bulwark, and also similarly playing Falconeer, I just don't think the gameplay is there. They don't speak to me. This is not on my level. I don't understand really what the developer's going for. But there is a little bit of vision there that I feel like I want a piece of. Unfortunately, I'm just struggling to find it. I had a pretty bad experience with Bulwark. I just felt like I was kind of wasting my time and I didn't get what I should be doing or what the goal of it was. So I don't know. I just feel like there's something here, but I'm not grasping it, or maybe it's not being surfaced properly. I walked away from it feeling a little bit confused, a little bit disappointed. But gosh, you know, when the third Falconeer game comes out, I guess I'll probably give that a shot too. I really want one of these to connect, and they just haven't yet. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe a third time is a charm. We'll see. So that was Bulwark Falconeer Chronicles. Next up is a game called Ruff Gnor, RuffGhanor. This is a story-based deck builder that comes from a small team. This is a pretty, well, it's an interesting one in that I think the developer really knew what they wanted to do. I feel like they really focused on it. I feel like they achieved it. Basically, there is a story of full disclosure, I didn't quite fully understand the story because I believe the team is not from United States. I think they are probably not native English speakers. And the translation was not great. The English script didn't quite work for me. There was a pretty rough job done here. Some of the menus, I think, were not properly translated either. I believe I tried to change the subs or something, and like it was in, I want to say maybe it was Portuguese. I could be wrong. I may be wrong on that. So please don't be insulted if I got that wrong. So I think the biggest issue I have so far is that the subtitles are not great. The storytelling is not great. And I feel like that's probably a problem with translation. So putting that aside, it's the story of a boy who is defending a village, and there's like these little, it's a overhead 2D kind of a thing with some nice art, hand-drawn art, which I think the art is very attractive looking, looks good. You talk to people, you do these little side quests and have little battles. When you do a battle, you do card-based deck-building battles. It's not a roguelike. I think you have these preset battles, and then you build your deck as you go. It's pretty straightforward, but I say that in a good way because the developers clearly know what they're doing. Like, they know the mechanics. They understand it. They didn't get too fancy with it, but it totally works. Like, the cards work like you think they would work. The combat works like you think it would work. Everything is in the right place. It feels like it makes sense. And so, as someone who enjoys deck builders, I think this was great. I really like that they didn't get too fancy. They didn't try to work up some weird new concept that didn't click. Like, it's very meat and potatoes, straightforward deck building combat. But I think that's good. I think they really nailed what they were going for. Again, I like the writing. I like the concept. I like the idea of walking around this little village and having these little encounters with people, talking to them, and then doing the fights. In terms of the fights themselves, really satisfying. You got your attack, you got your defense, you got some magic. You have teammates that show up, and they have their own decks, which are separate. It's all, like, and again, I feel like I'm damning this with faint praise, and I really don't mean to because I had fun with it. I think it's just a very straightforward, like, adventure-based deck builder. And I think if the story was a little bit better, I think I would have higher praise for it. But I'm giving it praise. Like, I think it's good. I think it does what it needs to do. I think it does it well. I had fun. It's kind of like we say here on the show sometimes. Sometimes you just want, like, a burger, right? Like, you don't want to have, like, this fancy exotic meal. You don't want to go to too much work cooking something. You want to just, sometimes you want just something simple, and that's good enough. Like, if I, you know, want a regular meal, and I want just something satisfying, and I'm like, yeah, I'll just have a real quick burger. Nothing fancy. You have a burger. The burger is good. It's not anything exotic. It's not crazy, but it's satisfying. And I think that's what the space that Ruffkanor occupies for me. It is exactly what it looks like. It works the way that you want it to work. It does it well. And then I think that's good enough. Like, it achieves its goals, and I had fun. So it's not like pushing the boundaries. It's not bringing anything significantly new to the table. But in this particular case, I think it works well, and I had a good time with it. I do feel a little bit of disappointment in saying that the translation was not great. I wish the translation was better. The writing is kind of weird, and so that was kind of pushing me away a little bit. I think hiring a better translator would help with that. There were a few rough edges to it, too. I had a couple of crashes here and there. But overall, you know, this may not be like the next luminary of the deck-building combat genre. But I think for a small team, they did a pretty goddamn respectable job. And I think it's something to be proud of. So I am still chipping away at it. And I think it works well. It's good. If you want a good deck builder that tries a little bit of storytelling as well, I think this is a good one. Ruffkanor, Ruffghanor. Just expect a smaller team. Expect a few bumps and little hiccups and stuff. But overall, definitely worth your time if you like deck builders. All right, and let's see what's next on the agenda here. Oh, well, you know, the kind of catchphrase or the motto of the show has always been new stuff, old stuff, and anything in between. And I am walking that talk today. I'm circling back to one of my probably favorite games of all time. And a game that I would unreservedly say is probably as close to perfect as a game can get. I find no flaws with it. And if you know me, if you listen to the show, you read my reviews, you know I'm somebody who has no problems finding flaws. But this game is basically spotless as far as I'm concerned. What is it? Into the Breach. Playing it on Switch comes to us from, I believe it's Subset Games, if I'm not mistaken, the people who also made FTL. I've never played FTL. I kept waiting for it to come to console. Super disappointed it never did. Heard good things about it. And then they came up with Into the Breach next, which I think is just friggin' dynamite. So I've played this before. I finished it before. This is not new to me. But why am I playing this now? I want to give a shout out to Slugcat Stew from the Gaming in the Wild Discord, which is a very friendly and cool and welcoming place, a nice little corner of the internet. If you're not a member of the Gaming in the Wild Discord, it's probably one of my favorite places to hang out, so go check it out. Definitely recommend it, and you can sign up for them, and also sign up for our own Discord if you wish. Do double Discord. Anyway, thanks to Slugcat Stew. I forget how it came up, but they somehow picked this game up and started getting into it and really liked it. And they were talking about it in the Discord. And then I was like, oh, snap, I love that game too. And I didn't realize that there had, I mean, I did realize, but I forgot about it, that there had been some DLC. So when the game originally came out, I had finished it. I had done all of the achievements. I had beaten it with every team. And then I thought I was done with it, had the full experience. But then DLC came out afterwards that I forgot about. New teams, new content and stuff. So what are we even talking about? What is Into the Breach, if you don't know? It is a isometric turn-based tactics small-scale game where you have a series of mechs, like mech suits or giant robots. You have teams of three, and there's a bunch of different teams. I want to say there's like probably 16 different teams of three, maybe more or less, I don't know, but they all have different abilities. And they are grouped up in ways to kind of like help them synergize or to help them build off each other in such a way that it creates little interesting tactical opportunities when you play. And there's also a time travel aspect, which kind of explains the roguelike nature of the game. And there's also something that I think, I don't know that they pioneered this, but I know that they were notable for it. And I know a lot of people have taken cues from this after Into the Breach did it. But what I mean is how the game tells you what's about to happen. So you have your squad of robots. They drop down onto a grid-based map. The maps are small, 8x8. Seems pretty tiny, but there's lots of opportunity for play there. It just kind of goes to show you don't need a giant map. But what happens is you're fighting these bugs, enemy bugs. They're called the Vec, and they'll show up on a map, and they're going to like wreck shop. They're going to blow up some houses. They're going to destroy some power lines, whatever, whatever. And the interesting thing about this is that Into the Breach is in no way interested in surprising you. They are not interested in any gotcha moments, right? And I think that's really what kind of set it apart at first, because every enemy on the board tells you exactly what they're going to do the next turn. So for example, you'll have three enemies pop up on the map. They're bugs. And one bug will have a red arrow pointing towards a house, means he's going to attack that house. One bug will have a red arrow pointing towards one of your robots, meaning he's going to attack that robot. And one bug may, I don't know, drop a bomb or spit some acid or something. And there will be an indicator to show where that's going to go. So they want you to know exactly what's going to happen. There are no surprises. Like, literally everything is laid out for you right there. All cards shown. And what you do with that information is where the tactics come in. Because then you have to realize, okay, well, I have these three events I need to deal with. I have three robots. Can I respond to each one of these? Do I need to move in such a way as to take care of these threats and defend the people? How do I neutralize these robots or these monsters? And the options, while it initially it seems like there's not a lot of options, it seems really simple and straightforward. That's the furthest thing from the truth, because there are just basically like infinite possibilities. And there's also like so many choices to be made. A large part of this game is not just countering the enemies, but also sacrifice and about what is acceptable damage. For example, it's pretty common to be outnumbered by enemies if you don't kill them quickly enough. And so sometimes you'll be in a position where you simply cannot respond to each enemy. So you have to decide, well, I've got three robots. I can block three attacks, maybe four, maybe five, depending on which robot you're using. But I can't get them all. So which one do I need to prioritize? Which one do I need to stop? Which one's going to do the most damage? Which one is going to do the least damage? And then I maybe let the least one go because I simply don't have enough resources. Sometimes you also have to sacrifice a robot. Maybe sometimes there's no other way to solve a level than other than to put your robot in harm's way. You don't have the right missile equipped, or maybe you don't have the right action or something, but what you can do is put your robot in the path of whatever attack is coming, and your robot will soak the damage. Maybe take damage just and be okay. Sometimes they'll blow up and die. But you have to like constantly prioritize how to best use your available resources. What is the best use of your robots? What is the best use of their powers? How can you best respond to the constant bug attack? And I think it's just, it's fascinating. It's a great system. The interplay between the mech teams is amazing. I think the ability to see what's going on and to have all the cards laid out on the table is amazing. It's a very straightforward, honest school of design, but it's also extremely effective. Like, there's no tricks. There's no surprises. If there's a mistake made, it's always on the player for not, you know, not strategizing properly enough or not knowing enough tricks, not equipping properly or whatever. I think Into the Breach is just fucking fantastic. I love it so much. It is basically a perfect game. It's perfect on the Switch as well. I think the size of the playfields, 8x8, is really small. The mechs are pretty small. Everything's small, but it is just the right size. So it does not feel small on the Switch. It looks like a good size, an appropriate size. All of the information is called out on the screen. If you're curious about something, you can always look it up on the screen, and they surface all that information. There's nothing really hidden. You can pause. You can very frequently like reallocate power-ups or power up between levels. Lots of secrets to discover. Graphics are great. I mean, it's just like the total fucking package. If you like turn-based tactics, this is like absolutely one of the top of the genre. I mean, I don't know that they ever come better than this in terms of pure design, in terms of mechanics, in terms of just like the brain power and clarity of thought that went into this title. So I did everything in the game before the DLC came out. I forgot about the DLC. Slugcat Stew reminded me of that. And so I went back and I've been playing the DLC. And man, it's such an amazing game. It took me a hot minute, to figure out, okay, wait, what are the controls again? How does this work again? What am I doing? It took me one or two rounds and then it all came flooding back. I'm like, okay, yes, I'm back in. I get it. I remember this all again. And I've just really been enjoying it. I think the DLC added, I want to say, four new teams. New pilots for those robots. I didn't mention the pilots, but each pilot has a special ability. You can mix and match the pilots with the robots to get a better effect. There's also new enemies. There are new missions, new maps, I believe. So it really is like an extra victory lap for the game, more content, and it's all great stuff. I've really been learning the new teams and finding their interplays and talking to friends who are playing it now, and we're all kind of like training strategies. What pilot do you think is best for this? Oh, how did you get this achievement? Which map do you think is better for this and that? There's just so much to talk about, and it's just such an amazing game. If I remember correctly, we did review it at GameCritics.com, and I believe we gave it a 10 out of 10, and I think that was absolutely appropriate. I think it is not only a brilliant game, it pushes things forward in terms of design, in terms of concept. It's like brilliant execution, brilliant fit for the platform it's on. I mean, I don't have any complaints there. It's like as close to perfect as perfect gets. So I think it's amazing. Big thanks to Slugcat Stew in the Gaming in the Wild Discord for reminding me that this game existed and for bringing me back to it, because I really have been enjoying it. It's been impossible to put down, which is bad because I've got so many other games to play for the show and for the site. It's trouble to pick this game up because it's really good, but I love it. Into the Breach is the fucking best. It's great on Switch, and I highly, highly recommend it. Highest possible recommendation if you've never played it and if you like turn-based tactics or that kind of thing. It's the shit. It's the ultimate shit. It's so good. That is Into the Breach, playing it on Switch. All right, last game of the show is another Crab's Treasure, coming from Aggro Crab. This one just dropped on Xbox Game Pass. That's where I'm playing it now. I believe it's out on everything. But since I do have Game Pass, it's kind of a quote-unquote free game. Don't pay anything other than the monthly subscription. So I figured I'd jump in. Why not? Been pretty excited about this one. This is the Undersea Colorful Souls-like, which features a hermit crab, actual hermit crab, cartoony looking, as the protagonist. And so you have this undersea adventure. We've been seeing trailers for a while now, and I've been pretty stoked for it. I'm glad it finally came. I'm glad I got to jump in. So basically, it is a Souls-like. It's third person. You have a basic attack, a charge attack. You use a fork as your weapon. You also have dodge, parry. Some of the stuff is locked up at first, though. So like when you first begin the game, you may feel as though it's pretty bare bones, because it is. I do think they commit the minor sin of locking basic genre moves or genre expectation moves, locking those behind a skill tree, which I don't think should be like parry. If you're going to do a parry, and folks, you really don't have to, but if you're gonna, I think that should be available from the get-go. But here it's a locked option behind the skill tree. I believe the downward attack, like when you're dropping onto an enemy from a ledge up above, that's one that's locked up. I think the dodge in the middle of a jump, I believe, is locked. So there's a few basic expectations where any Souls player would reasonably expect to have those moves available from the start, and those are locked behind a skill tree, which I think is kind of a bad move. It takes a little bit too long to kind of get your crab up to speed to where you start to feel like, okay, now I've got the skill set that I'm expecting from a Souls-like. You get there before too long, but it's just kind of like a minor point of irritation. Graphics are super colorful. It reminds me a lot of, like, I don't know, The Little Mermaid or something. As I'm playing this, I keep having like Under the Sea playing in my head. Sebastian the Crab's voice playing. Your crab is not named Sebastian, but it just, you know, I don't know, mental association, I suppose. So you go about your business. The story is basically that your shell is stolen by a loan shark, who is an actual shark, but he's like a shark puppet. Doesn't matter. Shark takes your shell because you owe taxes to the queen of the tide pools. You got to go and talk to her and see if you can get your shell back. You go down there. I guess it's a, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, but basically I'll just leave it at that. You're after your shell. You go talk to the queen. Events happen. And then you go off on this like Souls-like adventure. And it is intentionally and absolutely a Souls-like. I mean, there is enemies. There's a lock on. You dodge. You don't really deal with stamina too much, so I don't think stamina is a factor. So maybe if you feel as though stamina management is a core part of Souls-like, then maybe you don't think it qualifies. I don't necessarily think that all Souls-likes must have a stamina factor. I think you can make one without it, and I think this is a good example of how to do that. But the other key part to this, other than it handles kind of like you would expect, is that your shell, since you are a hermit crab, not a regular crab, but a hermit crab, that plays a big part in how the game goes. So as you might imagine, if you're familiar with hermit crabs, they have a soft abdomen and they need to protect it by hiding inside of discarded shells and shell-like structures. So in this game, you pick up a wide variety of different shells, and they're not always shells. Sometimes your first one is like an empty soda can. You get a sriracha cap. You know, the hot sauce, you get a cap from the hot sauce, you get a bottle cap, you get a coconut, you get a tennis ball. There's a bunch more. I haven't discovered them all, but like there's like, I want to say like 40 or 50 different shells. And not only do they have different weight and different defensive properties, some can take a lot more damage than others, but they also each have a special ability. And I think that's really like where the key difference of another crab's treasure come in, because depending on the shell you have, if you have, you can do like maybe magic bubbles that heat seek your enemies. Or one is you roll up into a ball and dash forward. One is you have a really strong uppercut. One is you heal yourself. One is you spin around like a top and you do like, you know, strikes on everybody in your vicinity. So the shell abilities are pretty fun. I think that's a cool idea. I think the shells kind of break down a little bit too quickly. The ability to kind of change it up and to get new abilities keeps it fresh. I think the overall combat, though, I think suffers a little bit. It doesn't feel as tight or as tuned as I really need a good Souls-like to be. And that wouldn't ordinarily be a problem, but with another crab's treasure, I will say it is bizarrely difficult. Despite the fact that the graphics look like they were picked up off the cutting room floor of The Little Mermaid, I mean, colorful undersea, blue water, sand, bright coral, etc., etc., it's hard. It's really hard, and I think it's kind of like unwanted hard, like undesired hard. I feel like the difficulty of this game is at odds with the presentation and the vibe. And with that, in conjunction with controls that don't feel as tight or as tuned as they need to be, it has a really kind of like awkward, kind of janky feeling to it. I feel like I'm not able to predict hitboxes effectively enough. I feel like it's not quite as responsive as I want it to be. It does not have the level of responsiveness that I would demand from a game that is very ready to deal punishment out. Now, when fighting the normal enemies, I think the normal enemies is not really that big a deal. There are larger enemies that can cause you some trouble, and the bosses I feel like are out of control. I feel like every boss, I think I've beaten three or four so far, they're all too hard. Like they take too much damage, they deal too much damage. It's hard to read their movements. The controls don't feel as tight as they need to be because the stakes all of a sudden get really, really high. You die pretty quickly. And I found them to be pretty unpleasant. So I think that the developers are a little bit confused. I think if you were doing like a Grimdark Souls-like where everything's blood and zombies, like that kind of primes people mentally to be in for a rough ride. But the graphics and tone of Another Crab's Treasure is really light and fun and airy. And you want to just kind of like roll around in the sand and enjoy the blue water and have fun. And then having your ass handed to you by this boss that's just going like aggro crazy doesn't feel good. And I don't think it's a tonal match. I think they've whiffed that a little bit. So I think they should have scaled back and gone for more fun, instead of like leaning into the more difficult aspects of a Souls-like while trying to couch it in this like colorful wrapper. I don't think that fits. It doesn't make sense to my head or my hands. Now, I will say, to be fair to them, they have included a slew of difficulty and accessibility options, which I think are great. And I want to say this. If you don't take anything else from this section, please take this away. Aggro Crab and Another Crab's Treasure have definitively proven, without a shadow of a doubt, that you can craft a legitimate Souls-like and include difficulty and accessibility options that do not take away from the experience. So they have put in a slew of options, and I absolutely celebrate them. I give them the biggest props, huge thumbs up, standing ovation for doing this. So in the options, you can have increase your damage given, reduce your damage taken. You can increase the durability of your shell. You can choose to not drop your souls when you die, because that's here too, doing the souls like corpse run. You can simply not drop them when you die. You can turn off fall damage if you fall off of ledges, which I suggest because you fall off ledges all the time. You can also speed the game down to like half speed, which is what everybody was screaming for in Sekiro, which I would have killed for, and was one of the most successful mods for Sekiro. So I think that they have crafted this experience. I think the base vanilla experience is too hard. I think it's unfriendly, and I think it's a little silly because I don't think it's a good fit for what they're going for visually. But I absolutely appreciate the fact that they prove you can put in options and you can let people tailor a Souls-like to their taste without destroying the experience. So huge props for that. Now, the biggest thing that they put in as an accessibility feature is one that I think is fucking wild. It was really highly publicized before the game came out. If you've been following the game at all, I'm sure you probably know about this already. But the biggest accessibility feature for this game is a gun. So what happens is, if you get into this game and you feel like the combat is too hard, what you can do is there's a toggle in the menu that says give your crab a gun. You turn that on, and instead of a shell, he's got an automatic handgun. It looks like a 9mm or something, I guess. I'm not a gun guy, but I'm guessing it's like a 9mm gun or something, strapped to his back where the shell would be. It's like a human-sized gun. It's enormous. It looks goofy AF. But it's single kill, one shots literally anything in the game so far. So I got to the boss number 2. I was really struggling on it. I was getting annoyed. I just wasn't having a good time. And it wasn't the kind of difficulty that made me feel like I wanted to lean in and fight. It made me feel like, okay, I've had enough. So I go to the menu, click in the give your crab a gun. He appears with a giant fucking gun on his back. You take aim, blam. Shell goes out. The boss, dead. One hit. You move on. I mean, what a fucking, like, revelation, okay? I fucking love that they were so bold to be like, look, if you don't like our bosses and you want to just keep playing with the game, keep moving forward, which I did, strap on the gun, shoot the shot, move on. It was hilarious and very welcome. I only did it as last resort. But if that's the difference between me moving forward and quitting the game, then I think it was worthwhile. And I don't think anything was lost. I did it of my own volition. No one forced me. You know, I didn't have anybody screaming get good at me or anything like that. And if you're a player who really does want to get good, I mean, number one, you know, everybody's mileage varies, so if that works for you, great, but it doesn't work for everybody. And don't belittle people who don't subscribe to that philosophy, but no one's forcing you to do it. These are all optional toggles. You can play the game on its base difficulty if you wish. Nothing is stopping you from doing that other than your own self-control, right? So I love that they put that option in there. And how great would that be for people who like Souls-like in general, but just don't want to play the game that difficult? How great would it have been if you could just like kill millennia from Elden Ring with one shot and move on and just get the rest of the game, you know? Like, I think that's great. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I think it's wonderful. Letting people opt in like that is fantastic. But overall, I will say I don't think the game controls as tight as it needs to. It doesn't feel as good to fight as it should. I think it takes a little bit too long for the special abilities and options to pop up. I think they should have sped that up a little bit. And I think the dichotomy of friendly, warm, cartoony aesthetic, which is very pleasing, with the, oh, watch out, my boss is going to spank you so hard right now and you're going to cry difficulty, that's kind of a misfit. It doesn't really work for me. So I think it's okay. I think it's all right. I may play around with it a little bit more, but I'm not 100% sold. I don't know that I'm going to fully commit for the whole ride. I may not, but I think some aspects are okay, but some aspects are really good. And if nothing else, I do really want to celebrate the accessibility options. I think that in itself, its very existence, is a huge step forward for the Souls-like genre. And I want every goddamn Souls-like developer, including FromSoft themselves, to take a real fucking hard look at this and be like, you know what? We can do this too. All it does is let more people in the door. That's all it does. You don't have to force anybody to use it. It's not dumbing it down. It's not making it a baby game. It's just letting more people in who want to enjoy your game for reasons other than the nail-biting combat, okay? So, folks, take a look at that. All right, that is another Crab's Treasure, currently playing it on Xbox Game Pass, and that is it for the new games of this week's episode. All right, folks, that is the full game portion of the show. But before I bounce, I do have a couple non-game things to mention. Let me get to those right now. All right, first off, I have been watching Thundercats, the 1980s cartoon series from back in the day. It was one of those shows that I only watched haphazardly as a kid after school whenever I got home and got home early enough and had the right channel. TV was available and, you know, I saw episode here, episode there, but I never watched the whole thing. So I actually have now seen every episode of the original Thundercats and I'm glad that I did it. I can check that off my bucket list. That was good. And I will say that it was not nearly as good as I remember. In fact, I was pretty disappointed with a lot of it. It's broken up into two seasons, and I think season one is still solid. Like, it's still great. Lion-O, Chitara, Panthro, Tigra, Wile E. Kit, Snarf, the core characters, Mum-Ra, the bad guy, all the mutants and stuff. Like, when you're in the beginning of the show, the first season is pretty solid. Like, I think there's some good episodes there. You're learning about the world. You're learning about the characters. It's all fun, good action, very cool. But at a certain point, it seems like the writers just completely run out of steam. They basically wrap up the whole series and it feels like, okay, we're good. And I don't know what happened. Like, maybe they thought they were going to get canceled or something and they stopped, but then they got renewed, or maybe they just ran out of ideas. But basically they change setting. They are on Third Earth, which is a different type of Earth, I guess. They wrap it all up. They get rid of the bad guys. They restore goodness to the world. The good guys and their friends are all fine. Like, it seems like it's a good way to bounce and end the series, but then they go on for a whole other season. They go to a different planet and the storylines just get really bad. There's a lot of poor continuity, boring stories that don't make a lot of sense. Just like random characters showing up and disappearing. It just kind of falls apart, honestly. And I don't think it's very good at all. Like, so I still recommend the first half of Thundercats. I think that stands as a pretty great 80s milestone. But when you get to the part where they go to New Thundera, like, just stop watching. I honestly don't think there's anything worth watching once you get to New Thundera. So that was kind of a disappointment. And overall, just not nearly as good as I remember. But I will say, it's interesting because I'm a huge fan of Silverhawks, which takes place in the same Thundercats universe, comes from Rankin Bass Productions, who make Thundercats. And Silverhawks is like kind of like the redheaded stepchild. Like, people remember it and people like it, but it never got as popular. It was never as big. It's not as well known. But after having watched the entire run of Silverhawks and the entire run of Thundercats, I think Silverhawks is the better show. I think the characters are better written. The storylines are more entertaining. The continuity is better. The setting is better. It's more consistent. I think Silverhawks is just honestly the better show. It just really is. So I guess fight me if you wish. You can send me a message and we can debate if you want. I would love to have an 80s cartoon debate. But I think I'm glad I did it. But boy, that one, Thundercats, just did not hold up to memory. So there you go. Also, just finished the entire run of Star Trek The Next Generation. Was watching with the family, watching it specifically with the son as well. This was his first time ever seeing The Next Generation. I've seen many of the episodes. I have not seen all of them. So this was the first time I've seen every single episode in the order it aired. And I got to say, it holds up. It totally holds up. There's a few weird things. There's one season where like a pretty conservative writer got in the writer's room. I don't know how that happened. It kind of fucked things up for the show. They made some really strange choices and I didn't care for that too much. I think it's season two, I believe. But that guy got kicked out after season two and they got back to business after that. But you know, the crew like Picard and Riker, Deanna Troi, Worf, Geordi LaForge, Dr. Crusher, Wesley, all that. It's really great stuff. A lot of those plots still hold up. The show still holds up. The special effects aren't too bad. I will say I remember Wesley Crusher being the show a lot more than he actually is. He's not really in it for that long. He's like in it for maybe like two or three seasons out of seven. And I seem to recall him being like this like integral part of the show. And he was for a while, but like he basically disappears halfway through and he only comes back like one or two more times for the rest of the season or the series, which is really kind of strange. That doesn't jive with what I remember. But overall, it was great. The performances are great. Patrick Stewart is amazing. Brent Spiner as Data is fucking amazing. I mean, everybody's great on that show, but it just really, really holds up. I'm so glad I went back to watch it. So now that we finished the season, or the whole series, we have been watching the movies. There were four Next Generation movies, and I remember seeing them and thinking they weren't that great, but I'm like, well, we're kind of being completists now, so why don't we watch them? So we watched the first one, Generations, which introduces Jean-Luc Picard to Captain Kirk from the original series. That one was like, okay, it was fine. Then we watched First Contact, which kind of like retconned the Borg a little bit. That's where they introduced the Borg Queen, which has never really been a thing from the show. I felt like they're kind of making it up as they went along. It was all right. Just, it was okay. We watched Insurrection, and I think that's been the best one so far, which is interesting because I feel like it got pretty bad reviews. But this was one where the crew of the Enterprise go against the Federation because there's some dirty business happening. The administrators are not following the Prime Directive, and so they kind of push back, which was a cool one. I thought that was a good episode, or a good movie that could have been an episode of the show, and I say that in a positive way. We've only got one more movie to go, which I believe is the one where they clone Captain Picard. I don't remember liking that one, but we're going to watch it regardless, and we'll see what happens. But overall, Star Trek The Next Generation is still great. Still holds up, and I think we're probably going to do Deep Space Nine next. We'll see. Heard a lot of good things about that one, but I ended up not really watching much of that one when I was a kid, so it's going to be basically all new to me, which I'm very excited about. So we'll see that. Also, shout out to a TV show on Disney Plus called Renegade Nell. This is a brand new show. I believe it's a Disney original exclusive to Disney Plus. This is about, it takes place in the 1700s when people were wearing tri-corner hats and they were driving around in horse-drawn carriages. And the monarchy was like a big thing, and people were still dying of the plague and such. Basically, Nell is a woman, and she has, it's kind of unexplained. She has like a fairy who's with her, and the fairy is Nate from Ted Lasso. If you've seen Ted Lasso, the soccer show, the assistant coach Nate is that guy. So it was kind of funny to see him pop up again here. But basically, she is a take-no-bullshit woman in an era when women were supposed to be taking bullshit. So she stands out by standing up for herself. This is kind of a little bit revisionist history, but for the better, because not only do women play a little bit more prominent role here, but also people of color are interspersed throughout the entire cast. And so you see black people and brown people and Asian people in the lower cast, in the middle cast, in the upper class. It's like when people are walking around wearing those giant wigs and stuff and the fancy clothes, there are black people there, Asian people, brown people there, which is great. And so I think there's no real reason that couldn't happen. And I like the way that they've kind of incorporated that into the show. But basically, Nell has this fairy, and whenever somebody is threatening her, the fairy grants her these powers. And she basically goes into like bullet time from the Matrix. Like she gets super strong. She can like stop bullets with her hands. She does like crazy martial arts. A lot of really awesome action happens, like sword fighting and acrobatics and stuff. So she has that ability to protect herself. And so she's trying to get back to her home. I'm not going to spoil the whole thing, but like a lot of stuff happens. She goes on a bunch of adventures, and there ends up being this like really kind of dark supernatural slash satanic element to the show, where some of the monarchy or the people who are up in the aristocracy are like after her, and they start doing like these satanic rituals and summoning these monsters and everything. It's pretty cool. Like I really dig like the vibe of it's kind of light and fun. It's also kind of dark and spooky. It's really girl power. It's really like POC forward. And I think that it's just a great blend of elements that are both familiar and also brand new. And I really appreciate like the action heavy approach. Lots of thrills in every episode. It's just really, really cool. I think it's awesome. Renegade Nell on Disney Plus is much better than I thought it was going to be from the trailers. And we have been absolutely loving it, watching like one or two episodes a night. And it's just, it's really good. So definite recommend. Final recommendation of the show. If you're on Instagram, there's a person there. Their account is called Crikey99Art, C-R-I-K-E-99-A-R-T. They're on Instagram. They are a phenomenal artist. I love their style. It's so clean and so well produced. And this person really captures the essence of a lot of 80s stuff. They do some She-Ra art, Silverhawks, I believe some Thundercats, some other stuff like that. Mostly Silverhawks right now, which is great because I'm a huge Silverhawks fan. But they do like posters, mugs, t-shirts and stuff. It's available on TeePublic if you go there. But you can also see their stuff on Instagram. And I'm just like so in love with the style. I think the artwork is so great. I bought a shirt, a mug, two posters. I'm going to get some more stuff next time I get paid. I think it's really wonderful. So if you like 80s properties, 80s IP, 80s cartoon, and you want like some custom art stuff going on, I think it's great. Take a look. Crikey99Art on Instagram is wonderful. And that's a show. Checking my script. I think that's a show. Before I close here, I would love to ask you all to leave a review. Share the show on social media. Most important of all, please recommend the show to your friends, because nothing beats word of mouth. Also, if you'd like to support the show and help us out with the cost of running it, you can do that over at patreon.com/thesovideogamespodcast. And if you want to join our Discord, that is also free of charge. As always, we want your questions and comments. Hit me up, sovideogamespodcast@gmail.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Blue Sky. It's my name, BRADGALLAWAY, all A's, no O's. And this is going to do it for episode 386. Thank you so much for joining me here on the So Many Games podcast, and I'll see you next week.